Today, January 30th, is observed in some states and cities as Fred Korematsu Day. In 1943, Fred was a young welder working in his hometown of Oakland, California, when Japanese Americans were ordered to walk away from their lives for an indefinite period of internment. Korematsu was one of a trio of Americans who challenged their detention all the way to the United States Supreme Court. They lost. But after the war and his release, Fred got married, moved to Detroit for a few years, and went on with his life. His conviction was vacated in 1983 with established evidence that internment was grounded not in security concerns, but in deep-seated racism. Don Tamaki is one of the attorneys who worked on Fred Korematsu's exoneration. He's speaking at a University of Michigan law school event tonight in Ann Arbor. Don Tamaki, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The three people central to these cases, Fred Korematsu, Minoru Yasui, and Gordon Hirabayashi, they were an attorney, a welder, and a student, just young guys who didn't know each other. Did they have anything in common other than the fact that they were all Japanese Americans in the 40s who were told to report for detention?
And they're born in this country. Fred Korematsu was born in Oakland, California. Min Yasui was from the Hood River Valley in Oregon. And Gordon Hirabayashi was born in Seattle, Washington. Each took separate stands of conscience. They didn't know each other at the time. But when World War II broke out and orders to report to an assembly center to be rounded up and put in American-style concentration camps, each of them took their own stands of conscience.
What was the justification the Roosevelt administration was using in court to defend internments?
The government claimed that Japanese Americans were engaging in spying for Tokyo. And those claims took two forms. One, they were engaging in shore-to-ship signaling. And secondly, they were so different as an ethnic population. They lived in a separate Japanese-American community. They spoke a different language, a different religion, and therefore so different that they couldn't possibly be American, quote-unquote. And on that basis, this wholesale rounding up of Japanese-Americans, two-thirds of whom were born in this country, occurred. We now know, some 37 years later, after the imprisonment took place, that none of it was true, and the government knew it at the time.
The author of this policy, General John DeWitt, had acknowledged privately there had been no acts of sabotage, but in part, we know now, thanks to the work that you and others did on the exoneration case, that he believed that the lack of the attacks was evidence that there was a larger plot in the works. He was sitting, waiting for something big to happen and took a lack of sabotage activity by Japanese Americans as proof that something definitely would happen.
So the way it went down was, of course, on December 7, 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. And by February 19th of 1942, the president passed an executive order giving power to a general on the West Coast to begin issuing orders governing a civilian population, that is, Japanese Americans. And at first, General John L. DeWitt, was actually opposed to any rounding up, thought it was unnecessary. But at the time, the West Coast was rife with racial prejudice. It was a time when alternative facts and conspiracy theories really ruled the day. And General DeWitt engaged a colonel by the name of Carl Bendetson, a Stanford-educated lawyer who really should have known something about the Constitution, who basically began targeting this population. And even though there were not a single person arrested, let alone tried and convicted of sabotage, spun out the conspiracy theory that the very fact that no sabotage and no spying had ever occurred was a disturbing indication that in fact it would occur. So that's the kind of circular logic that was going on. The very fact that you've never committed a crime, you've never been accused of committing a crime, was proof positive that you would engage in criminal behavior.
What parallels do you see between the Korematsu case and the Muslim travel ban and other modern-day policies that have targeted people of color for a variety of perceived security risks?
The disturbing commonality in this case is the failure of the judiciary, the courts, to be a check and balance on the executive branch, that is the military and the president. And any good high school civic student knows that we have three branches of government, the legislative, the judiciary, and the executive. And each is supposed to be a check and balance on the other. the framers designed it this way in order to thwart, I'd say, the rise of kings and tyrants. And the rounding up occurred. Three individuals you mentioned, Fred Korematsu, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Min Yasui, said that they're American citizens, they'd done nothing wrong. The government had no right to arrest not only them, but an entire racial population, men, women, and children, and lock them up such that they lost their property, they lost their freedom, some even lost their lives. These cases came up fundamentally due process challenges. And ultimately, regrettably, in 1943 and 1944, the court took the position that when the government invokes national security, the safety of the nation, the court is not going to second-guess the military and the president. And what happened, as we know, was a civil liberties disaster. None of it was true. The government knew it at the time. There was an intentional cover-up within the Justice Department that went all the way to the Attorney General of the United States as well as the Solicitor General of the United States. That's a problem. In other words, when the courts stand down, they don't ask any questions. The temptation of decision makers to make politically motivated decisions to, for example, appeal to their base or to fulfill a campaign promise, that temptation becomes overwhelming. Why? Because nobody is asking any questions. People are looking the other way. And Japanese Americans, you don't have to remind them of the dangers of that in terms of what happened. Now, when these cases went up on the travel ban to the U.S. Supreme Court, the government made a similar defense. They said that banning countries, Muslim majority, six of them ultimately, was for the safety of the nation. When these cases came up and they were tested in the lower courts, in the Maryland Federal District Court, Judge Theodore Chuan said, what is the basis for shutting down travel, separating American families, for instance, Iranian Americans who are born here but are unable to see their grandparents, for instance, or their parents? What's the basis for that? And the government replied, well, we've done a Homeland Security report, global, and we've concluded that this makes the country safer. And the judge asked, may I see the report? And the government said, no, it's confidential. And ultimately, when these cases went up to the U.S. Supreme Court and was decided on June 26, 2018, nobody asked any questions. And the court basically said, you know, that Korematsu case, that was wrong the day it was decided. But by the way, this has nothing to do with Korematsu.
I think that's what Chief Justice John Roberts said.
That's right. Yeah. And if the government tells us this makes the country safer, then we believe the government. And the problem is this. The parallels between Korematsu and the travel ban case are disturbing. You know, both arose out of war. Both involved the government invoking national security in order to shield its decisions from any judicial scrutiny. Both involved a targeted minority. In World War II, it was Japanese Americans. Today, it's Muslims. Both involve hidden government reports that the government refused to disclose to the courts or to the public. And finally, both ended in the courts standing down, abdicating their constitutional role to ask probing questions. And the problem with that is that's how you begin to lose a democracy.
In 2014, the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was giving a speech in which he noted the Korematsu case, and he unequivocally stated that the initial ruling by the Supreme Court at the time was wrong. But he added, you're kidding yourself if you think the same thing won't happen again. And he went on to say that in times of war, the laws fall silent. If at the time a sitting justice on the United States Supreme Court holds that view, is there any hope to think that this would not happen again?
The only hope is the American people themselves. I appreciate Justice Scalia's candor in making that comment, but think about the ramifications of that. And I said, from a personal point of view, my families know the consequences of that statement. And that is to say that when the president invokes national security and basically says, trust me, this will make the nation safer, and then targets a population, let's say Japanese Americans or let's say Muslims, and those people are then rounded up. And it is a very popular thing to do. During World War II, the most popular thing was the vilification of Japanese Americans. General DeWitt had said, The racial strains are undiluted. The fact that there are second and third generation Japanese Americans born in this country doesn't matter. The very fact that they have not committed espionage and sabotage is proof that they will be. And so that was the invocation of national security and allowing that process to go through. And if that happens, think about the consequences it has for any other marginalized group in this country. And think about it in terms of any other policy, whether it's to construct a wall that Congress has expressly rejected the president from doing by denying appropriations for that. Think about the policy of separating parents from children. Think about indeterminate detention. I think we can think about it even in challenging congressional oversight. Today, we're watching, for instance, a president defying subpoenas, refusing to produce evidence, basically says, if I believe my reelection is in the national interest, it therefore follows that I can refuse any sort of congressional oversight. This is how dictators get started. This is how one begins to lose a democracy. This is history in some ways repeating itself. And so, of course, Japanese Americans are talking about their personal experience, but this applies to every American, not just Japanese Americans.
We have just about a minute left. When these three cases first came before the United States Supreme Court, was there dissent from the bench? Were there voices saying, this is too much power for the executive, we can't let this happen?
Yes, and they did so without knowing what the evidence was. For example, we now know that J. Edgar Hoover had issued an authoritative report saying, we've investigated every single claim of spying. None of it is true. The Navy said there was no reason to round these people up in the first place. They should be treated no differently than the Italian-American or German-American population. The Federal Communications Commission had said, we monitor the airwaves, and General DeWitt's men are picking up signals emanating from Tokyo and calling them shore-to-ship transmissions. They're false. And Justice Department lawyers said to the Attorney General and the Solicitor General, it is highly unfair to this racial minority that these lies be put forth before the Supreme Court. This is the only opportunity for the Justice Department to correct this. And ultimately, they were rebuffed. The evidence was suppressed. It was even fabricated in order to manipulate the outcome of these landmark cases. Even without that information, Justice Owen Roberts of the U.S. Supreme Court had said, you know, the government has put forth no evidence for the rounding up these people. Instead, we now have a principle before us that lies around like a loaded weapon, ready for the hand of any authority who can put forth a plausible claim of an urgent need. This is Scalia's quote. If the government asserts an urgent need, it can do anything it wants. And he said the principle lies around like a loaded weapon. What does that mean? That without evidence, without trial, an entire population can lose their freedom on merely the naked assertion, unsupported by evidence or by trial, that this group did anything wrong. That is so contrary to American principles and the checks and balances system of our democracy. And that's the danger.
Don Tamaki is a partner at Minami Tamaki LLC. He is going to be part of the discussion tonight at the University of Michigan Law School in Hutchins Hall for Fred Korematsu Day. Don, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.